Hey, profs, welcome on in. My name's Rob Lightfoot, proud two-time alum of Rick Edelman College of Communication, class of 2000-2001. This is Beyond the Brown and Gold.
I'm Jessica Kennedy. I'm the co-host here, also a two-time proud Rowan alum, class of 2008 from the Rick Edelman College of Communication and Creative Arts, and 2015 from the College of Education. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Rowan Radio 89.7 WGLS-FM presents Beyond the Brown and Gold, a show that highlights the lives and memories of Glassboro State and Rowan University alumni. Now, here are your hosts, Rob Lightfoot and Jessica Kennedy.
On today's show, we have a very special guest, Bob Catania, class of 1976, a Glassboro State alum.
But Bob did some big things here at the station, so we're a little biased towards Bobby.
I mean, Bobby?
Well, we're friends now. We talk.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. We didn't ask permission if that's what he wanted, but, you know, that's fair enough. That's a common nickname. But, yeah, Bobby. No, I can't do it.
Sorry.
Bob was great. He had a very unique time here at WGLS during a kind of pivotal time for the station, and then a really storied career in the music industry.
Yeah, he was on the... Many folks think when you get into radio that you have to just go straight into either on air.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what Bob's story is. Bob went a different route. You'll have to check out this episode to kind of hear where Bob's journey took him. So, Bob, where'd you come from? How'd you get to Glassboro State College?
I was living at the Jersey Shore, Ocean Township, right outside of Asbury Park. Living there, you know, worked on the boardwalk, which was really amazing. It was... I worked at Bubble Land, the kiddie rides on the boardwalk. So that was a fun experience, you know, going to concerts at Convention Hall and the casino and places like that, you know, Stone Pony and things of that nature. So I was always a music fan. When I was deciding where to go to college, you know, I was thinking, I'm not sure what I wanted to do for a living. And I always thought, well, maybe I'd be a teacher. And I don't know why, it just occurred to me. And I looked at the state colleges because I really didn't have the finances to go to a university or anything. And I looked around and said, well, Glassboro State College is the teacher's college. So I applied, got in, and it's really a lot about fate in my life. And I think everyone has that in their life. I got to the dorm and I was in the dorm room for just a few minutes, and the guy across the hall walks into my room, a guy named Joe Higgins, said, hey, welcome to the dorm. How you doing? I'm Joe. I said, I'm Bob. And for some reason, I to this day, I don't know why, I just asked him, I said, hey, is there a radio station on the campus here? I had no idea. And he said, well, I'm on the news department. Are you interested in the radio station?
Wow.
I said, sure. And he said, come with me. And I walked over to the station with him. It was in the back of the library at the time. They pulled something off the UPI machine, some teletype. And he gave it to me, put me in a booth. And somebody was on the air. And they went, read the news. And I read the news. And that ended my teaching career.
Like 3 seconds after you walked into your dorm.
Right, yeah. I was like... It's just like, I can't believe I'm on the radio. I don't know how many people were listening or whatever. I had really no idea about the station at the time. And, but I knew, you know, I had found my calling, you know, in terms of radio. I wasn't thinking music business at that point. So I joined the college radio station, and that really became the epicenter of my life for the next 4 years. I mean, I went to classes and that was all okay. But being at the radio station as many hours a day, every day of the week was really what it was all about. So, you know, I joined and I guess I was kind of a jack of all trades. You know, I was a freshman and I just did whatever, you know, was asked of me, you know, read the news, file albums, you know, do whatever. So, and then, you know, with my interest in music, I got really fascinated by the fact that there was a huge record library there.
Still here.
And I think that vinyl library is still in a back room there somewhere.
Yes, it is.
I did see that during my 50th, and I was really happy to see it. And it had all of the the coding system that I came up with when I alphabetized the library one year.
Look at that.
Well, so, as somebody who uses the vinyl, I have to thank you.
Because when I went in there, there was just thousands and thousands of albums in no particular order.
Gosh, and
my little OCD brain went, well, this isn't going to work. So I'm not sure when I got onto that, but over time, I got more involved on the music side of things. I was looking at an old resume the other day. I guess I became the music librarian at some point. And that's when I decided in my spare time, I should alphabetize these 10,000 albums, and come up with a system so that, if you went in and said, I want to play David Bowie, you would go to B and there would be the David Bowie albums. Mm-hmm. And then I had them, organized by the release dates and so on and so forth. So, I got very involved with the station. There was people like Jim Servino and Jeff Weber. I think you guys both know I think they were both maybe a year or two older, but they were the guys that I really looked up to, and these were two of the smartest people I've ever met, and still talk to them regularly after all these years. And Jim was really responsible for saving the radio station, because there was talk at one time of them closing the station down, and I know Jim went to one of the deans there and said, we can make this work, don't make it go away. And I think that might have been when they brought Mike Donovan in to be the faculty advisor. So, Jim and Jeff and Mike were certainly big influences on my early time there. I was talking to Jim about Mike the other day, and I didn't realize at the time when he became our faculty advisor, he was probably about 2 years older than us. He seemed much more mature than, I guess I thought he was much older, like 28 or something, he was just a kid like us.
You're growing up in Asbury Park with there being such a big music scene there, like you said, with the Stone Pony and everything. Do you think that influenced your desire to pursue music or your love of music?
Well, I think that certainly didn't hurt. But, in high school, I was a huge, music fan. I had tons of albums and I would listen to WNEW, endlessly all day long and go, this is what I want to do. My ideal job would be to be on the air at WNEW, having no idea how one would do that or how that would happen. But that was sort of my dream. But, in the interim, being the music librarian, I kind of figured out that there was a music industry and that you'd have to write to people and call people to get records being sent to the station. And again, we were a small station. It wasn't like we were in Chicago or New York or even Philadelphia, where the record companies were actively looking for airplay. But, I started reaching out to some people, had some relationships, and really kind of worked on the whole music thing. The other thing, I don't remember when it happened, but I finally got an air shift. And, the station back then, so this would be...
Did you have to go through training? We had training.
What's
we had
that?
To go through training.
Training, but you also did you have to also do FCC cards or no? Were they a thing back then?
Yeah, we had to get an FCC license. Mm. I'm reminded by one of my friends back there who also did poorly. I think it took me 3 times to pass the FCC license. The technical aspect of things were kind of beyond me, unfortunately, but I finally got it. I guess there was some training where it might have been Jim or somebody else, one of the older guys would come in and go, here's how you work the board. It was a pretty simple board back then. And it was all vinyl, and we had carts, for the commercials or the PSAs, because we really didn't have commercials. So they taught me how to cue up a record, and somebody goes, here's how you slip cue a record. So it's easier to talk it up. You could just hold the album and then let it go, and it would go right into the song. So I did get some training. I think the format at the time was probably more of a top 40 format. I was more of the progressive rock guy. And there was other friends of mine, Bob Wass, Bob Fox, Craig Denning, Guy Malarino, There was a few of us that were more of the progressive rock nature in terms of our music. A bunch of us managed to get the Bill Spence. I don't think I mentioned him. We all were given like this 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. slot. So I guess they figured, well, we can get these guys out of our hair, get them on the air, make them happy, but nobody will be listening to them, you know, at 1 o'clock.
Didn't matter to you though, right? As long as you're on.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I think all of us did the shows for ourselves and each other. I mean, there was many a night when, you know, I'd be listening to Bill or Bob or somebody and they go, "Hey, Bob Catania, here's something for you," you know, and vice versa. So, but it was pretty great. It was all this like free form progressive rock music. And we really had no formatting at the time, which I learned about much more as I got into the music business. But, you know, I'd get to the station a few hours before my show and I'd just go through the record library and pick out albums, you know, pick out songs, and I'd write out a playlist. I still have, because I'm a pack rat, I think I sent you a bunch of that stuff that I'd saved. I still have all my old playlists, you know, that I would look at.
That's phenomenal.
That's amazing. I tried not to even write my playlist while I was here. Really? So, yeah. Well, it was like weird when I came. We eventually started handwriting because there was like some in the computer and then we had to handwrite them for some reason. I don't know why, but that happened like towards my end. And I was like, oh, this is the worst. Oh, you know why? Because I had a microgroove and that wasn't scheduled music.
Specialty show, yeah.
So I had to write it all in, which was a pain.
I don't think there was any performing rights organizations looking for the playlists from WGLS,
probably not.
You know, to pay royalties and all. And quite frankly, the stuff I was playing and my friends were playing were really obscure. Like we would try to out obscure each other. The funny thing is a lot of the things we were playing, you know, like, you know, Electric Light Orchestra, you know, I was playing a lot of their music and, you know, I look at those playlists now and what was really avant-garde and bizarre back then, these all became, hits. You know, big mainstream, you know, stadium acts, you know, but we were playing that stuff, you know, really early on. So it was really exciting. And, you know, my heroes were the jocks at WNEW in New York and then WMMR in Philadelphia. When I got to Glassboro, I started listening to the, you know, the Philadelphia station. So it was like, well, if I don't work in NEW, MMR would be okay, or WYSP or WIOQ. But I remember one of the jocks on one of the stations, they had an intro song and an outro song. So I had to mimic them. So there was the Small Faces had an album called Ogden's Nut Gone Flake.
You know, that
brilliant
one?
Album.
I know Small Faces.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
This was an album from like 1966. It was like really one of the first concept albums and had the most amazing packaging you'd ever seen. It opened up. It was a circular package and it opened up eight ways, but the title track, Ogden's Nut Gone Flake, was an instrumental. So that opened my show. And then I ended the show with I Am the Walrus from the Beatles. And we signed the station off at 2 a.m. And at the end of the song, you know, you hear the Beatles all talking underneath the music. And that I would read the sign off over that. And then hopefully figured out how to turn the transmitter off, you know, because again, I wasn't technically all that good.
It seems like you spent a lot of time here. What did you do outside of the station while you were here at Glassboro State? Did you get outside of the station walls ever?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I went to my classes.
Oh, did you? Good. I'm starting to wonder.
Yeah. Those were sort of a sidelight. You know, I did all of that. All of us that worked at the station, we had a very strong social life together. We all became very close friends and socialized together. So that we were either at the station together or outside the station together. You know, my first wife I met lived in my dorm. So I spent obviously a lot of time with her as well. And you know, I lived, you know, outside of Asbury Park. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, I go up and spend the weekend, you know, see my parents and things like that. So, But really, I mean, the bulk of my time was at the radio station. That was really, you know, my passion, because I saw, you know, a path there to maybe, you know, have a job in radio. And then I guess my senior year, I became the station manager, which was really exciting, you know, and I was thinking about the being in my dorm room and going, is there a radio station here? And then a few years later, I was the station manager. So that was,
were you ever the station
that
manager?
Was pretty cool.
I was never station manager. I was always kind of like the guy who didn't want a title, but was stuck here all the time. Not stuck here. I love being here.
Yeah.
But like, I didn't want a title. No. How about you?
You never on executive staff?
No, no.
Wow. That's shocking.
Yeah. No, I was a rat here, but I never took a title here.
Yeah. So I was the station manager, but the interesting thing that was going on in my life is my roommate, Craig, had a friend from high school named Sam Vogel, and Sam didn't go to Glassboro, but had moved to Glassboro to have a social life because he knew Craig, and then he became part of our crew. And he was working at a record distributor in Philadelphia, Universal Record Distributors. And he was kind of the in-house guy, you know, dealing with radio stations and servicing stations. And Sam became an amazing friend to all of us. And what was more amazing is working at a distributor, which distributed maybe 25 or 30 different record labels like A&M Records and Arista, United Artists, you know, once a week, he'd come to the apartment and hand the bunch of us like, here's a box of albums for free.
We're very like, cool.
Free albums?
Yeah,
are you kidding? And then, and t-shirts and, you know, stickers and all the promotional stuff that record companies did. So, I mean, he was an amazing friend. And another one of those fateful nights, we were at a party at his house, and he said, you know, I'm so busy at work, I can't get all the mailings done, I can't keep up with the phone calls. And I had a pretty light schedule. I had gotten ahead of myself. I only had a couple of classes left to graduate. You know, again, my focus was the station. And I said, well, I could probably come in a few hours a week and help you out. So I got a job going into Universal Record Distributors. So I was in this mail room, and I was doing lots of, you know, errands and stuff. They would say, you know, if a radio station in Philly called up and said, our album has a skip on it, we need a new copy, they go, Bob, you know, run a copy of this over to WMMR. And I'd be like, oh my God, I get to go to WMMR. This is amazing, you know? And after a few weeks, I went to the guy who ran Universal, and I said, you know, you have me here doing this, that, and the other. There seems like there's a lot of things I could be doing if I was here full time. And he said, sure. And I think it was like this is in 1976. I think they paid me $100 a week, but I was working in the mailroom, and I thought this was the greatest thing because now I was inside of a record distributor where I could get to meet everybody. So I reluctantly gave up the station manager job because I was going to do this. I went to a couple of professors, and they weren't heavy duty classes. They were like, write a paper and, you know, we'll give you a B or something. And, I actually left school a couple months before graduation and started working in this mailroom. And it was the foundation of my whole career, because in that mailroom, I met people from, you know, 25 or 30 other record labels. You know, I was dealing with people from the home office who were calling up for things. You know, I was the mailroom guy. I mean, don't get me wrong. I was down in the warehouse dragging records upstairs, putting them in mailing envelopes and sending them out. But at the time, I was also, you know, radio stations from all over the region would call in. And eventually I started just talking to them and promoting them on records. And I still have these. I started two different newsletters just as the mailroom guy that I sent out to radio stations every week. I had a top 40 one and a progressive rock newsletter where I talked about all the the records that were coming out of Universal at the time. And
you wrote those and distributed those yourself?
Somebody typed them up for me because I couldn't type, but I would handwrite them. And then we'd mimeograph, 50 copies or something. And I had a mailing list of all the program directors and music directors and started sending them out. And, I would include albums in it or singles, whatever struck my fancy. So, it was just kind of a natural thing for me to want to do. And, so a lot of those radio station people really liked me. And, one day I heard that, RCA Records was looking for a rep in Philadelphia. I didn't really know how to get an interview for that job. And to this day, I'm always grateful. The program director of WDAS, which was the urban station, Butterball, Joe Tamboro, he used to call in all the time. He'd come up to the office and he was great. I had a desk right in the front door and he'd come in and he'd go, "Hey kid, how you doing?" He'd put a 20 on my desk and go, "Hey, go out and get me a sandwich and something, get yourself something," because he'd be up there for a meeting with all the promotion people. He was just really nice to me. And I was talking to him one day. He goes, "Hey, kid, what's up?" And I said, "I hear there's an RCA job opening, but I can't figure out how to get an interview." He goes, "Do you want that job?" I said, "Well, I'd like an interview." And he put me on hold and came back on the phone 5 minutes later and said, "Okay, you have an interview next Wednesday at some hotel somewhere." And I went and interviewed with a guy from RCA and ended up getting the local RCA promotion job.
That's wild.
So that,
thank God for the connections you made, that really helped you climb that ladder. Imagine somebody's just like, you're like, "I want this job," and somebody just is like, "Hold on a second."
Yeah, but look at the initiative you took with the newsletter, because I wanted to place that in context, because everybody gets emailed newsletters now and it's so easy to distribute those. Here you were taking the initiative as a young buck trying to make your way here.
Mm-hmm. And writing them out.
And you're writing them out, type them up. Right. Mail them out.
Yeah.
It kind of separated you from maybe some others and you got some notice that way, I'm sure.
Right. I think, over the years of in the business, when I've talked to people about how do you get a job in the business, and obviously everything changes over time. There wasn't always the mailroom, route, but I always tell people, like the internships are so important. You get inside. You get to know people, mm-hmm. You make relationships, you get to, you know people, you find out what's happening. And in the music business, and I'm sure it's like this in a lot of businesses, when people start looking for employees, they go with someone who's familiar.
Yeah.
"Oh, that kid in the mailroom, he seems like a nice guy. He's hustling. He didn't complain when I said, go get me lunch, He put stuff in my car for me, the product that the guys were promoting, all of that stuff." So I always tell people, because everyone always wants to start either at the top or the middle, And I said, no, you start at the bottom. And it's funny, I have so many long-term friends from the business, people that started out as interns for me. There's one guy, he was calling me before, he came to me when I was at Island, and I didn't have the job that he wanted, but I said, "But there's a job in the mailroom." Mm-hmm. And he went, "I'll take it."
Yeah.
I went,
"Yes, you will."
Maybe I should have hired him for the job, because it wasn't like that's beneath me.
Right.
And he was in the mailroom for a few months, and the guy that I hired didn't work out. And this guy from the mailroom, everybody in the company knew him and loved him, and he had this work ethic. I mean, he went on to have a huge career in the business, but it started from the internship. So I'm always grateful to the GLS experience would not have, that was a great foundation. The relationship with my roommate to the high school friend led me to Universal. One other thing I just want to mention, I don't want to drone on too much. When I was at GLS, there was a college radio convention in Chicago. A group of us went, and I met a program director who was programming a station in New York. It wasn't WNEW. There was a station, short-lived WQIV. It was a quadraphonic radio station. The concept didn't didn't last too long. But the guy said to me, hey, when you get back, if you want to come up and visit the station, you know, I'd be happy to see you. I'm like, well, program director of a New York station wants to talk to me. So I went up and I'm in his office and we're talking and he goes, hey, hang on a second. I have somebody I have to see who's waiting to see me. And this guy like bursts into his room. He's got a satin jacket on. He's got a satchel over his shoulder. And he pulls out a copy of a new Wings album. And he's like, hey, I don't remember the program director's name. He says, here's the new Wings album. And here's the key cut and this, and handed him some other albums. And it was like a whirlwind. It was like 2 minutes. And then he was gone. And I went, who the hell is that?
Can I be that guy?
What was that? What did I just witness? And he said, well, he's the Capitol Records promotion rep for New York. I go, well, what does that mean? He goes, well, he promotes records for Capitol Records in New York City. And that was my other moment of like, I'm not going to be a teacher. I'm going to be on the radio. It's like, I'm going to be that guy, you know? Yeah. And I saw that and I go, that's what I want to do. I don't want to be on the radio. I want to be the guy that promotes the people who are picking the music for radio. So when I got that RCA job, it's like, mission accomplished. I was now the Philadelphia version of that guy. And I got to go to MMR and IOQ and YSP and WFIL and promote records for RCA Records. It was like, I know this is a cliche, but it was like one of those, I can't believe someone's paying me to do this.
Yeah.
You know?
A very cool moment.
If I didn't have a wife and a house and all that to support, I probably would have done it for free. It was amazing.
You can't tell anybody that. Now, you've had a career that has spanned over 40 years working in the industry. So why don't we highlight some of your key moments in your career? I know so much to cover, right? How can we fit 40 years right. worth of a career in this episode, but let's talk about some of your hot career highlights.
I was the RCA local guy in Philadelphia and eventually was promoted to the New York office to be a national promotion person. So my territory was now not just Philadelphia and the surrounding area. I had a responsibility for the entire country and some management, you know, responsibilities, you know, within that. I did that for a couple of years. And then one of the guys I worked with at RCA moved over to Island Records as the head of promotion. So he brought me over to be the head of album promotion for Island Records. And I couldn't have been any happier because Island Records was a label. I loved everything on that label as a fan. You know, they were a kind of a progressive British rock label owned by Chris Blackwell, one of the most iconic people in the music business. And I was like, I get to work with Chris Blackwell and promote the music of that label. Was just, I couldn't believe it. So I was the head of rock promotion. So I was in charge of a specific format, rock radio. So there was somebody else who handled Top 40 radio. Actually, my boss, who was that head of promotion, did that. And I did all the rock stuff. So, you know, we had a lot of success. It was when I first got there, one of the first albums I worked was The Unforgettable Fire from U2. People will ask me, in all your years, what's the hardest artist you ever had to promote? And I go, that's easy, U2.
Yeah.
And people, they start laughing. They go, come on, they're huge. Back in 1984, 85, when I started promoting them, not everybody wanted to play them on the radio,
yeah.
you know?
Yep.
And that was probably one of the greatest, you know, promotion challenges, you know, we all faced at the label, you know, promoting U2 and breaking them to the level that they're at now. My boss, Phil, left to go to another label, and I became the head of promotion for Island Records. So I was now in charge of the entire promotion efforts for the label. Probably to this day, the best job I ever had, because we were an indie label. So we weren't a corporate label. I'd be on the train from Middletown into New York, and I'd be kind of dressed like this, and all these poor miserable guys in their suits and overcoats, you know, going to their corporate jobs. And I'm like, I'm in my t-shirt and jeans, because when Chris Blackwell would come into the office, who owned the label, he came in wearing, you know, a shirt and jeans and flip flops. You know, he was from Jamaica. So you couldn't really go to the office dressed up. You know, you'd be looked at as really strange. And we had this really eclectic group of artists. A lot of them never were successful, but they were really cool. But in the midst of that, we had U2, Robert Palmer. One of my greatest projects ever was Melissa Etheridge, where, I mean, I spent probably, and other people in the company, but about 2 years just taking her, visiting radio stations and trade magazines, and she would play, you know, in somebody's office in the afternoon and then play a club at night. I remember being in Buffalo with her, and we went to the radio station of the day, and I think she played to about 40 people in some club that night. And a couple years later, you know, I was with her backstage, you know, at a sold out Madison Square Garden.
Did you get to meet a lot of artists during your time? And what was that like? Was that like mind blowing for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, it was a job. I mean, some artists were fantastic to be with. I mean, I worked U2 for many years. I think I maybe met them once or twice. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of existed in their own little bubble, but, you know, I still did my job, you know. So when you're running a promotion department, it's really interesting because, you know, you think of, well, I'm talking to radio stations. Well, radio station relationships were obviously vital. And when you became a senior VP or a head of promotion, you were expected to know hundreds of program directors, which I did. And there was a certain level of, you had a local staff and maybe a regional staff who were the day-to-day people. But, you know, the head of promotion was supposed to be the heavy hitter who came in and, you know, made the call. And it's like, wow, Bob's calling me. This must be really important.
Yeah.
Or when there was a big promotion, like the band's going to be in town and the radio station wanted to do a presents, like, you know, WXRT wants to present U2. There's a lot of politics that go into that. So I would have to be involved. But, you know, I was dealing with radio. I had to deal with my staff. I put the staff together and then had to maintain that staff. And promotion people can be an odd bunch of people to work with at times. So you had all those personalities to deal with.
That's what I did here.
I had to deal, well, like with the jocks, you know, any staff. You know, I had the upper management of the record company that I had to report to, you know, the president or the GM, the artist managers. That was a huge part of my job, you know, dealing with the managers who, you know, the great managers always looked out for the interests of their artist, you know, full time. I mean, Bill Leopold, who was managing Melissa, still a great friend of mine all these years later, you know, was the best manager I ever worked with, because he motivated me to make sure I was doing everything I could for Melissa. And he would deliver things that we needed as well. And when I said to him, we need Melissa Etheridge to visit 100 radio stations with her acoustic guitar and play in a conference room for 8 people, he said, done. Not a problem. You know, we'll go do that. And then, of course, you deal with the artists. And certain artists I dealt with a lot. Melissa and I were very close. I got very close, like, with Lisa Loeb over the years. And then some artists just lived in their own little bubble. But so there was a lot of, you know, things to juggle in terms of doing that. And then, of course, the responsibility of the head of promotion is to craft the program to promote the record. So, you know, you say, this is going to be the new single. This is when we're going to release it, in terms of the whole release schedule of the label. You know, because obviously we weren't working just one record at a time. So I'd have to organize how records were promoted and when, and then execute that game plan. So over, you know, the course of the year. So, and then there was conventions and all that in the middle of it where we would bring artists. So there was a lot to do in that job. Eventually I got a job offer from Geffen Records, which brought me to Los Angeles.
I was just going to say, what brought you to the West Coast? Because I know that's where you are now. So,
yeah. So I came out here, I think, in 97 to be the head of promotion for Geffen Records. And that was a great experience. I was working for them in New York, but then they brought me to L.A. to run the promotion department. Unfortunately, about 18 months into it, there was this huge merger of the business. And for the first time, I was on the right side of the merger. Mm. And it looked like I was going to have a much bigger career. And then the accounting people came in and said, to make this merger work, Geffen Records needs to go away.
Oh.
So 90% of us lost our jobs. So like 2 years after I moved out here, it's like goodbye job, you know, and I continued on. And then eventually I went on my own, doing my own independent promotion stuff. You know, I worked smaller projects for independent artists. And then I was working with a guy up until the end of the year where we had a company where we were getting music played in stores, you know, something, you know, completely different. But, you know, the whole business has changed. You know, the job that I did, it still exists, but barely, because the whole streaming revolution, you know, everything became, it's all about streaming. Radio was still important, but then radio got very corporate.
Yeah.
You know, the things that I was able to do with radio back in the day doesn't happen anymore. You know, these, the iHearts and the Cumulus and the Town Squares, they began to centralize their programming. So, you know, there was three people making the decision for hundreds of radio stations. So the need for, you know, someone like myself and even a staff, you know, to go out and have relationships with individual radio stations just kind of went away.
And now even artists are not even releasing full albums. They're doing songs, some are just doing songs, and then we're, you know, they're
done. Yeah, the world of Spotify, you know, the concept of an album is almost antiquated now, you know, that you know, you just put out a song.
Not unless you're Taylor Swift, because those albums are like,
I know.
You know.
It's funny. I have a friend of mine that has an online rock magazine, and I was kind of analyzing his business for him, and he puts out issues, but the issues are just a series of links.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's really no, it's not even a magazine. It's just, you go to the online magazine and you have to click on 20 different links.
Yep.
I said to him, stop worrying about the issue. Just put out the stories. It's like Spotify. People don't go, wow, there's a new, well, they might go, there's a new U2 album out, but they're more interested in what's the new song.
Yep.
You know, the band drops a new song and it hopefully streams quite a bit. So it's a very, very different business.
Now, Bob, I have to imagine that you have a very, very, very cool room at your house with all of these records.
Well, I did for many, many years.
Come on, man.
I,
of all the things, yeah, we have GLS playlists, but we have no records on the walls.
Well, you know, I had, you know, the, you know, like 100 gold albums, you know, and 5,000 vinyl albums and CDs and memorabilia. And then over the years of, you know, moving, when my wife and I made our last move, it was kind of like, okay, you know, do we move thousands of albums, and what am I going to do with all these gold albums? Like, I went to my kids, anything you want? And they're like, we don't want any of your stuff. You know? So, the music that you grow up with from a certain age, you know, I don't know, 16 to 40 or whatever, that's the music that sticks with you. And I think legally you're supposed to not like what your kids like, you know? So yeah, we watched the Grammys the other night, and, you know, there's a lot of the new stuff. You go, oh, okay, that's, you know, like, I appreciate a good song. And I think Miley Cyrus is tremendous. And
yeah,
I love the fact that, you know, Dua Lipa opened the show, and I'm like, why is she inside a cage with 25 people dancing and all that stuff?
That's how she gets attention.
And then Miley Cyrus comes out and just, it's just her singing her ass off and singing a great song with a great hook and a melody. And, you know, we watched the Eras movie, Taylor Swift, and you got to say, you know, she's putting on a show like Bruce Springsteen does, you know, three and a half hours. Mm-hmm. It's career spanning, great production values. And, you know, she has her dancers and stuff, but it's still, you know, it's not about the spectacle. It's about her and the song. So yeah. I appreciate that. So we just, unfortunately, we've downsized it all. It's
where
just,
did it go?
You know, it was a lot of work to move it all, but I, you know, I have the memories of all of that stuff, you know, so.
Stuff is just stuff, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. True story.
Yeah, it is. You know, over the years, I would go, oh, I really wish I still had that album. And then I go, so my wife, Karen, and I, it's really more now about the experiences that we can do versus stuff. You know, that's the things. And I just have to say a quick aside, the music business has been very good to me because I met Karen, was working at RCA Records in Los Angeles when I was in New York, and we were friends for many years. And then ultimately, you know, we've been married. It'll be 20 years in December.
So what have you been doing in your retirement to enjoy all these experiences that you have?
Technically, I always try to say I'm not retired because I'm still looking for other things to do. But we, you know, after the holiday break, Karen and I went to Australia for 2.5 weeks. So we've only been back a couple weeks. So we're just kind of getting caught up. And, you know, right now I'm just having the lunches that I haven't been able to have with people, catching up with people that I haven't had a chance to catch up with, and then planning more trips and things like that. So far, so good.
Jess, just the guy in the mailroom. That's how he started.
You know when people say mailroom, I always think of like the movie Elf.
Oh, I do.
Have you ever
seen
Elf? And he's like in the physical mailroom. Yeah. So I was like envisioning that. And then when he talked about it, I was like, no, it's not the mailroom that we're talking about. But Bob talked about this, and then Mike, whose interview already aired, both talked about starting at that kind of entry level position. Yep. Even if you think you can do the mid or the senior level position, starting at the bottom, putting in your time,
yeah, paying your dues,
making the connections, so important to making a name for yourself.
And he kept rattling off the big names of the record labels like they were nothing. Like, oh, yeah, I just worked at RCA, then Island. Mm-hmm. And it was
No big deal.
We just kind of did these things. I worked with you too, Robert Palmer, Melissa Etheridge. Very cool.
Very cool. Well, we always love talking to a prof with a unique story, and we were happy to share Bob's story with you today.
You've been listening to Beyond the Brown and Gold on Rowan Radio 89.7 WGLS FM. You can find more episodes on your favorite podcasting platforms by searching for Beyond the Brown and Gold or Rowan Radio On Demand.